vaguely familiar with the term Calvinism, but there are also a great majority of preachers who don't really have any idea what we're talking about when we talk about Calvinism. And frequently, Baptists are wrongly classified as being Calvinists, just because they believe in certain doctrines that are taught in the Bible that Calvinists also believe. You see, that's not a good criterion for putting a label on anyone. There are some things Roman Catholics believe that Baptists also believe. And I suppose there are some things that Jehovah's Witnesses believe that Baptists also believe. And even, you know, the list is endless of things you might find in common with other persuasions, other denominations, other religious groups, and all people everywhere, as far as that's concerned. But I think we need to understand exactly what we're talking about when we say we are either Calvinist, or we are Arminian, or we are something else. And so, in order to fulfill that that need, I've undertaken to try to explain exactly what we're talking about when we use the term Calvinism. And I hope you're taking notes on this, and I also hope that you're interested in the subject. You will take time to go to any good library and look up the life of John Calvin, the life of Jacob Hermann Arminius of Holland, and the subject of Calvinism, the subject of Arminianism, terms like supralapsarianism and sublapsarianism and infralapsarianism and a lot of other things that may sound like garbage, but you also might find that you could be very well enlightened if you would just take the time to go to a good library and look up some of these terms in a good encyclopedia, not necessarily a religious encyclopedia, although there are more notes on theological questions than a religious encyclopedia, such as the Scott Herzog's Encyclopedia of Religious Knowledge, or Baker's Dictionary of Theological Terms, or some other books like that, that have good, concise explanations of what these terms mean. We're going to talk today about Calvinism, and in order to talk about Calvinism, we need to know where we got that name. We get the name Calvinism from a man by the name of John Calvin, who was born July the 10th, 1509, in northern France, in the section of France called Picardy. And he died in his in the city for which he was really famous, and that was Geneva, Switzerland, May 27, 1564. John Calvin, originally, was a Roman Catholic. He was born a Roman Catholic, and not only born into a Roman Catholic family, but he became very religious at an early age, and in fact decided that he would become a Catholic priest at the age of 12. His father was a very wealthy man, so he sent John Calvin to school to study for the priesthood. And I don't know exactly how long he attended his priesthood studies, but we do know that he became a very well-educated man, and he served not only as a Catholic priest, but he was a chaplain for a large university, and also was a teacher in that university, and taught Catholic theology. However, while he was studying in a Catholic seminary, he became interested in a Reformation movement that had started sweeping the world as a result of another ex-Roman Catholic priest in Germany by the name of Martin Luther, who had decided to start a rebellion against the Catholic Church. When John Calvin began studying Luther's theses, he became dissatisfied with the Catholic Church, and so in 1532, he officially separated himself from the Catholic Church and became a part of the worldwide Reformation movement. However, about 4 years before that time, he had changed his major in school. His father became alienated from the Roman Catholic Church, and he ordered his son John to change his studies from theology to law. And so we know that for 4 years of Calvin's life, before he became a part of the Reformation movement, he attended law school, and while he was in law school, he studied classical subjects as well as Hebrew for a few years. Then he took up with the Reformers. About that time, King Francis, who was the King of France, had become interested in this Reformation movement, and he made a study of it. But after he studied what the Reformers were teaching and what the Catholics were maintaining, he decided that France would remain a Catholic nation. So he did what a lot of Catholic people did at that particular time in history. He just simply issued a kingly decree that France is going to be Catholic, all non-Catholics get out. And so, that's one good way to build up a church, is just exclude all of your opposition. And so, as a result of that decree from King Francis, Calvin was ostracized and expelled from his home country, from France, and he went to Switzerland. He first went to Geneva, where he was invited by a gentleman by the name of William Farel, F-A-R-E-L, who was a great Reformation leader, to become a part of the Reformation movement in Geneva. And Calvin did join forces with Mr. Farel. They became so strong, in fact, in their contentions about doctrines that we now know as Reformed doctrines, the Calvinistic doctrines, that the officers of the city government became very fearful that these men were going to take over the town. So they expelled them from the city of Geneva in 1538. Calvin was given 3 days to get out of Geneva, April 23rd, 1538. He went to Strasbourg, and he lived there for the next 3 years. While he was in Strasbourg, he wrote a very famous document that is now known as John Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion. Those institutes at first were just a small one-volume document. Later, as Calvin studied the subject more and was requested by some of his brethren to expand on his thoughts, he expanded until the Institutes of Christian Religion finally became several volumes, but originally it was only one volume. While Calvin was in this sort of an isolation period in Strasbourg, there was a Roman Catholic cardinal by the name of, he had a funny Italian name of some kind, and I can't recall it, Jacopo Sadoleto. Cardinal Sadoleto wrote a letter to the official government hierarchy in Geneva and more or less demanded that Geneva return to the Roman Catholic camp. So when they got this letter and they knew that this was a kind of a mandate from the Roman Catholic Church, and furthermore, in those days, there was a church-state relationship to the extent that when a Catholic official gave some kind of an order, it had the same effect as being like a presidential edict from the head of the country. And so when they got this mandate from the good cardinal that he wanted Geneva to return to Roman obedience, to accept the Pope as the infallible head of the church and the ruler of the religious world, these Geneva officials became very alarmed at this. By this time, several good friends of John Calvin had become members of the ruling government of Geneva, known as the Council of 200, 200 people that served kind of like the senators, representatives, city council men, not only of Geneva, but of all of the territory of Switzerland, which they ruled over. And so they sent an official request to John Calvin that in effect says, would you please come back to Geneva and draft a response to the cardinal's request so we can answer him in the right way without getting into trouble. So Calvin came back as their invited guest. He never held a political office. Nevertheless, he was installed as a kind of a religious lord mayor over the city of Geneva, and his power as a religious leader became even more powerful than that of the Pope of Rome over that particular territory where he lived. He was given authority by the Council of 200 to establish laws and controls over the moral and religious activities of the citizens. So Calvin drafted the moral laws for the citizens of Geneva. Those moral laws were so strict that they forbade all kinds of entertainment and secular amusement. Then Calvin set up a group of people to assist him in enforcing these laws. And he named certain people to be in charge of education, others to be in charge of recreation, others to be in charge of regulating business as to their morals. In other words, they had to close up on Sunday and properly observe religious holidays and things like that. There were others who were in charge of church activities. And these assistants of Calvin were known as presbyters. These presbyters absolutely controlled the social, moral, and cultural lives of the city of Geneva down to the smallest detail. Several years later, the Presbyterian Church as such was not in existence at that time, but several years later, there was a man in Scotland by the name of John Knox who became a very well-known reformist leader in Scotland, rebelled against the Catholic Church, and was a student of Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion. And so when John Knox decided to form the Church of Scotland, he used John Calvin's government structure in Geneva as his structure for church government. And that's the way the Presbyterian form of church government came into existence. It was set into motion by John Calvin, and then later was perfected into a church type of government by John Knox of Scotland. And the Church of Scotland, the Presbyterian Church, incidentally, remains the official Church of Scotland today and still uses that same form of church government. Calvin was a correspondent. As far as we know, he never met Martin Luther. There isn't any record anywhere that he ever met Martin Luther in person, but he was a correspondent of Martin Luther. He exchanged letters with some of the other Reformation leaders of his day, including Zwingli and Martin Luther and quite a few others. And it should be noted, too, that as you study the history of Calvinism, you will find many references by their official historians to a group of people called Anabaptists, who were not a part of Calvin's Reformation movement. They were not a part of Luther's Reformation movement, but they were a separate people. As a matter of fact, John Calvin held a public debate with some Anabaptist leaders on March the 16th and 17th in 1537. And after this debate, he influenced the Geneva Council of 200 to pass legislation banning the Anabaptists from Geneva because he said their influence was too strong and he felt that they would be a detriment to the official religion if they were allowed to stay. In 1561, there was a split between the followers of John Calvin and the followers of Martin Luther, which resulted in two major branches or divisions of Protestantism. And we now refer to those two major divisions as the Lutheran division and the Presbyterian division. However, the division was over a somewhat complicated interpretation of the doctrine of election. These two divisions gradually became known by some very tongue-twisting names. In fact, they're so tongue-twisting that they're extremely difficult to pronounce. But John Calvin believed a doctrine that was known as supralapsarianism. It's not only hard to pronounce, but it's even hard to understand. But this is, as simple as I can make it, the breakdown of that doctrine known as supralapsarianism. Calvin said that first of all, there was God's election, and secondly, God's creation, and third, the fall of man, and fourth, the redemption. Now, you might hear that term supralapsarianism under another name sometimes in theological discussions. You might hear it referred to as fatalism. It's easy to see why it would be called fatalism, because if election came before the creation of man, you see what that would lead to? That would mean that God created man intending for him to fall. He created man, and it was a part of God's purpose for man that he should fall by disobedience to God's command. Consequently, everything that happened to man was not something he chose to have happen to him, and really his disobedience was not responsible for it, but man would become disobedient to God because God intended for him to become disobedient. Why do we call that fatalism? Well, some people say because that means that what is to be will be, whether it ever happens or not. In other words, if you lie, it's not really your fault because God intended for you to be alive. And if you steal, well, God intended for you to steal. That was a part of God's purpose for you that you do that. That was John Calvin's position, incidentally. He was strongly insistent on the supralapsarian theory that God first elected man and then created him, and when he created him with the express intention that he would fall away by disobedience and then would be redeemed, the elect of God's creation would be redeemed. Well, Martin Luther's followers took another position. They believed in election, all right, but they took a position that we now refer to commonly as sublapsarianism. The sublapsarian doctrine was a little bit different. Under the sublapsarian theory, first there was creation that was perfect. All creation was perfect originally, and then there came the fall of man. Because of man's disobedience, things became imperfect, and as a result of man's fall and becoming imperfect, then God elected certain men for salvation, and the rest would, of course, be not necessarily elected, but just left to destruction, and then following the election, the redemption. So there is a little fine point of difference between those two orders. Supralapsarianism is the fatalistic doctrine that everything man does is what God intended for him to do and the original purpose of God. The sublapsarian theory is that God first created everything perfect, but then as a result of man's fall, the doctrine of election came into being, and then from there on, the two theories are pretty much alike. Now, there, is everyone through with this? Okay, if you're not, sing out. There are certain things that that some men in history have in common. And I'm going to put some names on the projector for you and propound this question to you. What do these men have in common? Pierre Carolus, who was pastor of a church at Lausanne. Philibert Berthelier, who was the son of one of the most famous martyrs for freedom. Jerome Hermes Bonset, and Sebastian Castellio, and finally, a very famous person in the history of Calvinism by the name of Michael Servetus. All of these men had one thing in common. That is, they were imprisoned or killed by John Calvin for the crime of heresy. What heresy did they believe in? They didn't believe John Calvin's doctrine of supralapsarianism, and as a result of their disagreeing with him or refuting some of his teachings or writings, they were rewarded by being put in prison. One man out of those five was put to death. Michael Servetus was a Spaniard. He was a physician as well as a theologian. He was famous, in fact, in medical history for discovering and first writing about the blood circulatory system. But Servetus had a peculiar belief about the Trinity. Otherwise, it appears that he believed the same doctrines as the Anabaptists, and historically he was allied with the Anabaptists in Geneva, and finally became a part of the Anabaptist group in Geneva. But in his study of Calvin's doctrines, he accused Calvin publicly of perfidious, tyrannical, and unchristian conduct. Boy, there's some conflicting names in the history. The result of this opposition was that Mr. Michael Servetus was arrested and put on trial for heresy. On October the 27th, 1553, he was burned at stake. He was taken out in the town square of Geneva. His hands were tied behind him around a pole that put wood around him and set it afire, and he was burned to death. And Calvin's only comment about this execution was that later he said he argued with the Council of 200 about this and pleaded that he would be beheaded instead of burned because he felt it would be a more humane method of execution. Now, whenever a fellow wants to saddle me with the term or the label Calvinism, that's one of the very strong reasons for my objection to that term. I'm not an Arminian, and I do not believe the doctrine of Arminianism. And there are many things about John Calvin's theology that I certainly do believe, but the reason I believe it is not because John Calvin taught it, but because it's Baptist doctrine that comes from the Scriptures. You see, there is a difference between Calvinism and Arminianism and Baptist doctrine. And Baptist doctrine is based not upon what Calvin taught or not upon what John the Baptist taught either as a man, but upon what the Scriptures teach. And the fact that John the Baptist's doctrine and my doctrine happens to be the same is not coincidental, because he certainly was a part of the writing of the New Testament. Well, Calvin was certainly an opponent of religious liberty. One of the things that has characterized Baptists down through the years, for many, many years, has been their very strong stand for religious freedom. The Baptist position can be pretty simply summed up like this: I abhor heresy in all forms, but I would fight today for a man's right to be a heretic if he chooses to be. If that's his choice, then I would give him the same right that I take for myself. And that is, if he wants to disobey God, if he wants to ignore the teachings of the Scriptures, then he has not the right, but he has the liberty of conscience to do that if he so chooses. Okay, let's talk just a little bit now about where the term Calvinism originated. The term Calvinism did not necessarily originate with John Calvin himself, because during the life of John Calvin, it's quite possible that the term Calvinism was not even used. Later, after Calvin's death, there were those who studied his Institutes of the Christian Religion and other sermons of Calvin, other teachings of Calvin, who gradually brought into being the term Calvinism. However, it's almost impossible for us to make a complete study of the subject of Calvinism without also studying the life of a man by the name of Jacobus Hermann Arminius. Jacob Arminius was a Dutch theologian. He was born October the 10th, 1560. Theology, he became a part of the Reform movement in Holland. The Reform movement just swept all over the world. Everywhere there was Catholicism, there was also a Reformation movement of some kind. And so there were a great number of men who became somewhat famous in the Reformation movement, besides Martin Luther and Zwingli and John Knox of Scotland and John Calvin of France and Switzerland and Jacob Arminius and great many others. In fact, in nearly every civilized country in the world, there were reformers. But now, Arminius was a little bit different from the rest of the reformers, because when he saw the people in his country adopting almost word for word the teachings of John Calvin, he tried, unsuccessfully I might add, to liberalize these doctrines of Calvinism. And he preached to and pleaded with the Dutch theologians not to accept Calvin's doctrine of predestination because he thought it was not scripture. After the death of Arminius, he died in 1609, and in the year 1610, the Dutch government had an official church-state religion, just as most European countries did in those days. Every European country, every civilized European country had an official church state religion, an official religion that was adopted by the state, and the rules and regulations for the church were set up by a combination of legislators composed of the theologians in the church and the senators and representatives, etc., in the official legislation of the government. So the question came up in the Dutch government, what shall be the official position of the church, of the Dutch church, concerning the doctrines of Calvinism? Well, the followers of Arminius, those who had studied under Arminius and those who had adopted the theology of Arminius, presented a document to the Dutch government. That document which they presented was known as the Remonstrance. And that word Remonstrance is somewhat famous in history if you are a student of theology, because that Remonstrance, the word means protest, incidentally, contained 5 points of protest against the doctrine of Calvinism. Those 5 points of protest became known not as the Remonstrance, but actually they became known by a nickname. And I'm sure you know what that nickname is by now. The nickname Arminianism, because it follows the teachings of Jacobus Arminius. Those 5 points under the Remonstrance were a protest against Calvinism. They were drawn up in an official document. They were presented to the Dutch legislature, and the legislature was asked to consider these points and to make them the official doctrine of the Dutch Church. All right, here were the 5 points of Arminianism. Number one, that God elects on the basis of foreseen faith. What they meant by that was that God sees ahead and he knows ahead of time who is going to believe and who is not going to believe, and therefore on the basis of that foreseen faith or unbelief, God elects certain people to salvation and other people he elects not to be saved, but because of their unbelief. The second point of Arminianism was that Christ died for all men and for every man individually, But since not every person believes, therefore only those who believe are saved. Then the next point concerns depravity. Arminius said that man is depraved, and in fact he is so depraved that divine grace is necessary unto faith or any good work man does. And then he made a fourth point. He said this grace may be resisted by the individual. And then he made a fifth point with which I totally disagree. That is, whether or not all who are truly saved will persevere in the faith is a point not fully known. Or in other words, men may fall from grace. There is, he didn't say that they would do it. He said there is that possibility that men may fall from grace. Okay, so this became an official agenda for the Dutch government to consider. And there were some followers of Calvin who presented another document to the Dutch legislature. And that document was known as the Counter Remonstrance, and it received the nickname. And guess what its nickname was? Calvinism, because it followed very closely the doctrines of John Calvin. All right, what was the difference between Calvinism and Arminianism? Well, since the Remonstrance contained 5 points, the Calvinists in their Counter Remonstrance also. People talk about Calvinism, what the Calvinists believe, and most of the time you will hear that word T-U-L-I-P, tulip, mentioned, each letter standing for the first word of the 5 points of Calvinism, the Counter Remonstrance that was presented to the Dutch government in Holland. Total depravity, and the Calvinist means total inability, that the individual has no ability to be saved. He doesn't even have the ability to respond to the gospel. Therefore, if God elects someone to be saved, God gives him the ability to respond to the gospel, and those who are not elected are never given the ability to respond to the gospel, so they just go on their merry way and they're not ever bothered by the preaching of the gospel. Well, I'm tempted to believe that sometimes by the way some people act, but I do think that it's not exactly in harmony with the scripture. I do believe very strongly in the doctrine of total depravity, and I tend to talk about that more in these lectures, because total hereditary depravity is the basis for most of our theology about the plan of salvation. However, total depravity and the total inability of the individual to respond to the gospel are not exactly the same thing. The second point of Calvinism, the U part of it, unlimited, or not unlimited, but unconditional election, that there are no conditions upon which God bases his election of the individual to salvation. The L part of it, limited atonement, that when Christ died, he did not die for all men, but he died only for those who were elected to be saved. The I part of it, irresistible grace, that the individual who is called to salvation because he is one of the elect has no ability to resist that call. And finally, the perseverance of the saints. Now we say the preservation of the saints. The reason we say that is because that's exactly what we believe. That's what the Bible teaches. That we do not persevere because of any power we have, any innate ability we have, but we are preserved by the power of the Holy Spirit. You can't keep yourself saved, but the Holy Spirit can keep you saved. Okay? The 5 points of Calvinism. Total inability, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and the perseverance of the saints. That's where we get the term Calvinism today. That's exactly what it means. That's the history of it. And tomorrow we'll talk about the doctrines themselves and what the Bible teaches.